This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, 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 hello. I hope you're enjoying the summer. That's the last time we'll see summer for about 9 months, or any sun. But I think we've been basking in it after the year and a half we've had. This is such an important show today. What we're going to do today is we're going to talk about the coming cut, which is what it is. That's important we talk about that, to universal credit, which is the way the Tories rejig the welfare state. We'll have a bit of conversation about that as well. And at the same time, of course, as you'll be aware, the Tories are hiking national insurance, which will disproportionately affect many low-paid workers, including care workers for that matter, to pay for the social care crisis without even resolving it, which we'll mention a bit as well. But after a pandemic, which has had terrible, not just health consequences, but economic and social consequences, the Conservatives are going to slash the real terms income of low-paid workers across the country during the biggest crisis we've had since World War II. What are the consequences of that? Well, what we're going to do today is we've got a brilliant expert who many of you will be familiar with, Professor Jonathan Portes. We've had him on before. And we'll talk about what this actually means, the economics of it, the impact this will have, how regressive it all is. But often this conversation about the welfare state is often about those people who are affected without including them in the conversation. Now, we want to rectify that. So we'll be talking to a brilliant activist from Disabled People Against the Cuts. And it is very important that we know that disabled people have been obviously hammered in the aftermath of a financial crash they had absolutely nothing to do with. And Disabled People Against the Cuts have been at the absolute forefront of much of the activism organising disabled people to have a voice and to fight back against these cuts. And we're also joined by someone who will suffer the consequences of the cut in universal credit and what that will mean for her and for people like her across the country. And as I said, that's so important that the megaphone is actually passed on rather than people like myself, however well-meaning we might be, those journalists who want to challenge the onslaught against the British welfare state, that megaphone is passed on to those who actually live those experiences. And we will talk later as well to the brilliant chair of Young Labour, Jess Barnard. You may have heard something of, the Labour Party civil war of the last few years, nothing would cease to amaze me. The chair of Young Labour being facing disciplinary action for calling out transphobia on Twitter. There was a prompt-ish U-turn after social media outrage. What on earth does this tell us about the current state of the Labour Party, the broader offensive, of course, against trans people, which in this country has often descended into new lows, but also what's going on in the Labour Party conferences coming up. Before I bring in our first amazing guest, normal housekeeping. If you're watching this live, do click on the YouTube link. So if you're watching this on Facebook, if you click on the YouTube link, it just helps the show. Press like, subscribe. For those supporting us on Patreon to keep this all on the road, we've got lots of documentaries coming up, including, finally, we're going to get this documentary done on Who Really Owns Britain. We're looking at wealth and power in Britain. It's going to be a really important documentary, as well as documentaries from Labour Party conference. I'm dreading it. I'm not going to lie. I'm absolutely dreading it. I have never dreaded Labour Party conferences as much as I have before. It's going to be an interesting experience, but I'm also going to Conservative Party conference as well in my hometown Manchester, so there's something out of it. I could probably drink my sorrows away in Canal Street, where I used to be a barman, but we will be there at Conservative Party conference, and we will do a documentary about what's going on in our party of government. It's going to be the things I don't know what I've done in a past life to deserve that particular sojourn. But there we have it. To support the show as well, use Super Chat. That's Patreon. So if you support us on Patreon /OwenJones84, £3 a month or whatever, that keeps the show on the road. It allows us to make these documentaries. It allows us to make the podcast Many of you will be listening to this on the podcast, so do like and subscribe to the podcast as well. Or you can support the show with Super Chat, where you can support the show and put questions on YouTube to our guests. Right, that's enough for me. I'm bored of my voice. So we're going to bring in our first fantastic guest, Professor Jonathan Portes, whose work on a whole range of issues, I have to say, is exemplary, whether it be, for example, on immigration. He's really been at the forefront of pushing back against the tawdry lies pushed by the anti-migrant lobby in this country, but also on issues of social security, for example. So, Jonathan, it's really good to see you again. How are you doing?
Hi, good to be back.
Great to see you again. So, before I want to get your reaction to something. We've got a clip of a Conservative minister who has been questioned on Sky News about the cut to universal credits. So let's just have a little look at what he says.
The thing we don't need to speculate about is the £20 uplift in universal credit. We know that that is going to be done away with quite soon. That makes the difference with some families between putting food in their kids' bellies and not. How can we possibly justify that?
Well, I think that when it was introduced as a temporary measure to alleviate the challenge that families' finances would feel during COVID, and set against a growing jobs market where there is now opportunities for employment for very many people, there is an opportunity to say that that temporary measure is no longer required. Now, clearly, I understand that for many colleagues and for many in society, that is challenging because people have adjusted to having that money. But it was introduced as a temporary measure. The economy has bounced back quickly. And so I think it is legitimate to look at withdrawing that temporary measure now that there is the opportunity for people to find employment again and to make the money for themselves.
And those who say my kids will go hungry as a result, what would you say in response to them?
I would say that is very, very sad to hear.
Lovely stuff. So, Jonathan, let's just start with that. So, explain maybe, some won't maybe properly understand how university credit works, what it is. It was obviously introduced under this government over the last few years. Ian Duncan Smith was the architect. So, explain that and what this uplift, what put it into context. I mean, it's interesting, the minister there saying, well, there's a pandemic on, the pandemic is no longer on. But equally, we can't have a public inquiry into the pandemic because the pandemic's still on. So this doesn't quite make sense. But just your take on that. Explain a bit about universal credit and what this means.
Well, I mean, I think in a sense, there is a very important point that comes out of this, which is that you can't look at what's happening with universal credit, both the temporary uplift and the cut that's coming in now, without looking at the context of the last 10 years. The very, very large cuts to welfare benefits that took place before the pandemic. It's just as, you know, some of you may have seen Sajid Javid on television this morning again saying, well, waiting lists for the NHS have gone up because of the pandemic. Well, that's absolutely true, of course, but it ignores the fact that waiting lists in the NHS have been going up for most of the last decade because of restrictions on funding to the NHS that were introduced well before the pandemic and obviously had nothing to do with the pandemic. And exactly the same is true with the welfare system. The reason that the uplift was necessary was because of the very large cuts that have been brought in, mostly over the last 6 or 7 years. So as you said, Owen, universal, and I think talking about universal credit as the cause in some sense slightly misses the point. Universal credit was a mess in lots of ways, the way it was introduced, the IT system and so on, because of Ian Duncan Smith's inability to listen to advice. But the basic principle of universal credit was simply that of consolidating a bunch of existing benefits, most importantly tax credit, into one benefit. And that in itself was not a cut, it was a sensible or at least a certainly perfectly defensible rationalization of the system. And indeed, in the original conception of universal credit, it would actually have led to some increases for some people in the amounts they got. Overall, it would have been good for low-income families rather than bad. So it's not the universal credit that's the problem. It's the simply the amount of money that's going into the system and the cuts that were made, particularly over the last 5 years, between about 2015 and about 2020, just before the pandemic. Two really, really big cuts being the most important there. One was the benefit freeze, where benefits were simply frozen in cash terms. So they eroded very significantly over that period. And the second, and arguably, I think perhaps the worst and the nastiest policy that this government and previous ones have introduced, the two-child limit for families in receipt of tax credits and universal credit, meaning that mothers or families who had a third child got no extra support at all. And of course, that has, exactly as was predicted, exactly as intended to do, has hit precisely the poorest and the most vulnerable families. So it's important to see that as the backdrop to the temporary uplift that was introduced when the pandemic hit, and try to make this about, oh, it was just a temporary bit of pandemic related support. It was just there for the period of the pandemic. And then getting into an argument about exactly when the pandemic finishes is quite the wrong way to look at it. It's important to look at this as part of a much longer, much broader attempt to erode the value of benefits overall for working families, for low-income families, working and not working, I should say. Because, of course, it applies to low-income families, whether or not they're in work.
So this cut, I mean, it's worth £6 billion of funding a year, but it's £20 a week. And the Financial Times reports a senior, well-placed Whitefall official saying the government's own analysis shows, and this is a quote, "the internal modelling of ending the universal credit uplift is catastrophic. Homelessness and poverty are likely to rise, and food banks' usage will soar. It could be the real disaster of the summer." And actually, interestingly, Rishi Sunak, whose popularity misplaced, unfortunately, but is one of the most popular government ministers, is one of those most ardently pushing to scrap the uplift. But even the likes of Ian Duncan-Smith have come out to demand it's uplifting. I think when you're to the right of Ian Duncan-Smith on the welfare state, it's a pretty gruesome place to be. But just in terms of the impact, I mean, what are we talking about? Because £20, what are we talking about in the kind of, in terms of the incomes of those workers, and not just workers, but what sorts of people are we talking about, and how difficult an impact is that going
to
make?
Well, I think one important thing is just to realize just what a huge proportion of the population this hits. We are talking about currently about 5 to 6 million people on universal credit. So it's probably about one in four working age families. So this is a huge number of people. It's a huge proportion of the population. And of course, it's a very big hit indeed. It's £20 a week is £1,000 a year for a lot of people in terms of their net disposable income after housing costs, the sort of amount of discretionary income they're having, that could easily be up to £1.10 or even more. So it's absolutely conceivable that this is very much the difference between just about managing, just getting by, and having your head below water. So that, I think, is the first important. To put it in historical perspective, I think the one really striking statistic which came out last week was that this is possibly the largest cut to welfare benefits in since World War II. So the largest cut since the establishment of the modern welfare state, according to the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, and that sounds entirely plausible. It is really a huge number. And in terms of what government officials may or may not have been saying about it, nobody's hiding anything about this. There's no secrecy about it. The sorts of models that people in the Department of Work and Pensions, where as you know, I used to be the chief economist, use to examine the impact of cuts like this are exactly the same as the sort of models the Resolution Foundation or the Institute of Fiscal Studies or that I use with my colleague Howard Reed when we've been doing modelling of the impact of these changes. And they all give the same results because, you know, actually it's not really rocket science to work out what happens when you impose a cut of a very large cut on a very large number of families. This is a lot of money for a lot of people. You know, as you said before, I wouldn't presume to talk about what exactly it means to individuals. People who are affected are in a much better place than I am. But looking at it as I do, because it's my job from this sort of helicopter perspective of spreadsheets and models and hundreds of thousands of people, you know, the magnitude of this is absolutely massive.
Simon Wakely here says, I've got a disability, which means it's almost impossible to find work due to accessibility issues. I'm on universal credit. I've just turned 25. However, when the payment goes back, I'll be £20 worse off. I mean, be interested just into, because obviously this does affect huge numbers of different sorts of people in this country. I do think it's interesting that actually the public mood has shifted on the welfare state, because at the beginning of the years of austerity, one of the ways austerity was in a sense popularized or got huge amounts of acquiescence was the mantra was huge amounts of public money is being wasted, and it's being wasted on the feckless, on the lazy, on the so-called scroungers. And I think that debate has shifted, hasn't it? But in terms of, you know, most people in poverty, aren't they? I mean, working households for a start. And that, I think, as the benefit cuts have spread and the reality has bitten, that has had an impact on the public consciousness, hasn't it? But I'm just interested in terms of the reality of low-paid work and the role of the welfare state in supporting people.
So I think you're certainly right that the way that a lot of the cuts to benefits, and particularly some of the nastier cuts, such as the benefit cap, which affects essentially people with large families living in high-cost areas, and the two-child limit, was legitimized, was very much by this sort of drip-feeding of stories to the Mail and so on about benefit scroungers or families with 10 kids living on benefits and all the rest of that. And I think people have realized over time that they were taken for a ride on that. And actually, of course, the vast majority of people who are dependent on benefits, tax credits, universal credit, are ordinary people, whether they're in work or not, or moving in and out of work, or struggling with disabilities, or as Simon, or whatever, that these are just ordinary people trying to get by. And the people who are losing out from a cut which hits 6 million people. And I think even this government would have a hard time to try and justify cutting 6 million benefits to 6 million people on the grounds that somehow they were all scroungers. But I think there's a couple of sort of further points that it's worth making, which was, in addition to that really sort of nasty rhetoric, there was also a slightly more respectable version of it that you got from people, you know, openly from people like Ian Duncan Smith or say Fraser Nelson in the Spectator or Telegraph, which is that, you know, money doesn't really matter, that being, you know, that there's much more to poverty than simply how much money you have. And it was really we should really be tackling the underlying causes of poverty rather than giving people cash benefits. Fraser Nelson complained to you that you know, Gordon Brown tried to solve poverty by moving numbers around on a spreadsheet, by which he meant, of course, that Gordon Brown put up tax credits and gave actual real people, you know, millions of real people, more money in their pockets. And I think, I hope that what we are getting a bit from this current discussion is that, yeah, actually, poverty really is about money. And yes, of course, that doesn't mean you don't worry about the underlying causes, low pay, the support we provide to people with disabilities, education. Of course, all those things matter tremendously. But at the end of the day, poverty really is about whether or not you can afford to have a decent standard of living for yourself and your family. And tax credits and then universal credit are there in order to ensure that's the case. And when you cut them, it isn't just a, you know, it may look like numbers on a spreadsheet in the Treasury. It may look like numbers on a spreadsheet to me when I'm doing my modelling. But the reality of it is it that giving people tax credits took people out of poverty, and cutting them will push people back into poverty. And that's, you know, it is as simple as that.
Just one other thing before I just ask you finally about social care and national insurance. Often rhetoric from progressives, from the left on issues of the welfare state, often it's quite a defensive posture. It's often about opposing the latest Tory cut, the latest Tory assault, I suppose, on the welfare state. In quite a, you know, stop the cuts basically, but without having a kind of reimagining of how there could be a different sort of welfare state which is fit for the realities of a country often obviously defined by insecure work. So what are your thoughts? Do you have any kind of general thoughts about the sort of kind of proactive demands people should be making about the welfare state rather than these purely, which are important obviously in the current situation where huge numbers of people face being driven into poverty, children amongst them? But what kind of other things do you think demands people should be making?
Well, in some ways, you know, some of what's happened during the pandemic has pointed the way forward. The fact that you know, the furlough scheme which was not perfect by any means, but was frankly pretty good in the circumstances and in the time it was invented. The fact that you can have a system like the furlough scheme, which provides a much more generous level of support for jobs than the normal system does, that you can introduce that, that you can do that without the whole sort of either the apparatus of the state falling over or the sort of pernicious effects that if anybody had sort of talked about the furlough scheme before we actually did it, it would have been shot down from all sides. And probably, to be frank, even people like me would have said that there would have been some major disadvantages. In fact, it showed we can do it. And while I'm certainly not suggesting that we have a scheme like that all the time, the idea that you can have some form of earnings-related support that is designed to produce a greater degree of job security for people, is hopefully out there. And we'll think about that as we come to think about how to redesign the welfare state. But I think, as you say, it's important to think about what, what does a new form of risk sharing between individuals, employers, and the state look like? That's what we're struggling with on social care. It's what we're struggling with on employment. I don't have the answers there, but I think there probably is a bit more space than there was a few years ago, both politically and intellectually, to talk about that properly.
So just finally, on social care, we've just obviously seen this hike in national insurance contributions. Can you tell us just how, I suppose, regressive that is? Go on.
I did get into some arguments with some people on Twitter on this, because it's not actually regressive. Hiking national insurance contributions in itself is not a regressive tax. Taxes on income generally aren't regressive. Who will pay most from this hike on national insurance? People like me, people earning very good salaries, especially those people like me in dual earner couples where both parties are earning a relatively good salary. We will pay the most. Now, that means we will be hit harder than super rich people, especially super rich people who don't get all of their money from wages. But that doesn't change the fact that actually national insurance contributions are across almost all of the income distribution. Remember that, I'm not rich, or at least I don't think of myself as rich, but I'm in the top 1% or certainly close to it in income terms. Yes, the super rich get off lightly, but the super rich get off lightly by pretty much any tax in the current structure. Overall, national insurance are a slightly progressive way of funding public services. They're not as progressive as income tax, but they're more progressive than VAT. They're a lot more progressive than council tax, which is the way we've been funding extra payments on social care for the last few years. So just as national insurance contributions were not a bad way to fund an increase to NHS spending when Gordon Brown did it, maybe not the perfect way, but not a bad way. They're not necessarily a bad way of funding increases in NHS spending or social care spending now. The problem is the really regressive thing about the plan is not the, in my view, the tax side. It could be better, but it's not the end of the world. It's the spending side. Where's the money going? The money is going on preserving people's inheritances. And that in itself is not necessarily a bad thing. It's a sort of insurance function that the state provides, and that, you know, there are good arguments for that for all sorts of reasons. But the idea that that is the priority when the real problem with social care system is not the fund, is not, you know, whether or not people get to keep their houses or get to keep their parents' houses when their parents die. The real problem with social care spending is that we're not spending enough money. We're not paying. We don't have enough staff. We're not paying them enough. We're not training them enough. And the quality of provision in many respects is pretty terrible. If all the money had been going there, then actually I wouldn't have thought this was overall an objectionable policy. It's not so much how the money's being raised, it's how it's being spent or how it's not being spent.
Jonathan, really appreciate it as ever. Thanks so much for going into detail, really fleshing out on the issue, obviously, of this horrendous cut to universal credit. And your expertise is always hugely appreciated. Do follow Jonathan Portes on Twitter. Do look him up, because always has expert analysis on what is going on in politics and on issues, as I say, not least in social security, but also immigration, where he's been an absolutely crucial voice. Much of my work quotes Jonathan Portes, as he knows. Thank you so much, Jonathan. Really appreciate it. And see you soon.
Thank you. Pleasure as always.
So if you're watching live, as I say, do click through to the YouTube link. And if you're listening to the podcast, hello, do subscribe. Right, we're going to bring in two other brilliant voices. And as I've said, it's so important that the megaphone is passed to those who are actually affected by what we're seeing, obviously, in the coming months and what we've seen over the last few years. So I'm really honoured to bring in Nella, who is a universal credit claimant. Hello, how you doing?
Hello, hi everyone. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great, see, I love the background. Lovely. It's a bit festive. I'm actually feeling a bit Christmas.
I had to make it a bit homely because it is a hostel after all.
Of course, which I'll come on to. I'll let you explain that. I'll also bring in with you Andy Green, who's from Disabled People Against the Cuts. Hello. To explain, though, Andy is not. So Andy's going to be the mysterious man. I like this. Normally, we obviously have people on video. For those listening to the podcast, we can't see Andy. But it gives him a kind of element of mysteriousness, which I think is appreciated. So hello, Andy. How are you doing?
Thank you for talking me up on. I'm delighted to be here and appreciate the opportunity to let people know what's going on.
Fantastic. And we'll talk a bit as well about Disabled People Against the Cuts, who've done absolutely critical work and do need the support of everybody. Nella, can I just start with you then? I mean, as you say, you're in a hostel, a YMCA hostel. So just you want to tell me about just a bit about yourself, about your background, how you ended up in the hostel, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's fine. Actually, I came into this hostel at a very awkward time. It was actually just before lockdown. I received a room. This one's in Hertfordshire at the moment, so it's a very expensive area, as we all know. Down south is quite expensive. So since about like March 2020, it's kind of been up and down. We're not allowed people in the building still, just to point that out. I've been claiming universal credit for a few months now. It's been really up and down, and to be honest with you, the way that it's going is, but the way that they're going, especially with the job center, I feel like really harassed, mm-hmm. more than usual. Even during a pandemic, we used to receive phone calls weekly instead of every 2 weeks, which was a bit excessive. So I'll kind of come on here to kind of raise awareness on that, if hopefully other people have had the same experience as me. But getting weekly phone calls of, have you got a job yet, when there's a pandemic, can really affect mental health issues and well-being in general.
So just tell me, in terms of, as it is, in terms of, as you say, you're in an expensive area, so just tell me a bit about how, in terms of balancing how hard it is to balance a budget as it is, and what a £20 cut to universal credit will mean to you in practice?
In practice, for example, there's like a £40 personal allowance where I'm living, in this YMCA, which they're asking for £40 extra of your personal allowance, which frankly I find that very disgusting. So if £40, which is like half of the cut, which is coming out, is out of my account, that's kind of like, well, I'm set back once again, which I already thought, you know, that £40 towards personal charges was already ridiculous, plus electric, plus food, plus you know, necessities and things like that. It's not enough to live on, in all honesty with you. And there's been times where I've had to go to the food bank, actually plenty of times. And, you know, it's a very horrible experience. It's the type of thing where you think, you know, oh, I'm in this type of, how can I call it? It's more of like a, you feel embarrassed to be here, even though it's not embarrassing. So that's how it kind of is at the moment. And personally, I think the way that it mainly affects people, including myself, is how are we meant to budget with such a small amount as it is?
I mean, on that, Nelly, you mentioned mental health, for example. I mean, the pandemic, lots of people have found the pandemic hard, but it's been a lot harder for some, including yourself. And to be blunt, Tory ministers who are cutting universal credit do not lie awake at night staring at the ceiling, wondering how they're going to pay an unopened energy bill on the kitchen table.
Yeah,
so do you want to tell me about the impact on all of this has on your, you know, the experience as it is living, having to constantly budget all the time to work out your outgoings with what limited money you have, and the stress of having that reduced further?
It's kind of like, I think it holds you on a social aspect as well, because I think I'll put this for example, I don't know, you want to go and have a nice time with your mates somewhere and you can't, because it's either that or there's no food in your fridge, or, you know, it's either that or your electric goes off. And I think that's the kind of like thing that puts people in a further kind of isolation as well, socially and financially. And I don't think, you know, people that are quite well off will ever understand, to be honest, unless they're put in that position of, I've lost everything, here's square one. And to be fair, it's always been a war on the working class. So, well, it's just, they're just, I think it's just like they're confirming what we're already saying for years now, but at a higher level.
Amen. I'll come back to you, Nella. That's really brilliant, though. I'm just going to ask, bringing you, Andy. Now, we had someone earlier, Simeon Wakely, who said that he has a disability, which means it's almost impossible to find work due to accessibility issues. I'm on universal credit and I've just turned 25. How, when the payment goes back, I'll be £20 worse off. Do you just tell me, in terms of how difficult things have already been, you've been at the forefront of fighting on this for disabled people over the last few years with cuts to various social security entitlements, and what this latest cut on top of that will mean? Oh, blimey. Sorry. Go for it, Andy. Attacking myself there.
No problem. excuse me. So, yeah, I think to set the context, really, I think we have to kind of firmly use the framework of the UN coming in and finding this government, which at the time in government had welfare reform as its flagship to be re-elected. But the United Nations found the Tory party committing grave and systemic violations of disabled people's human rights, upon which was the bedrock of welfare reform was built. That policy collection was designed to be punitive. It wasn't a byproduct of or fallout from decisions. It was shaped that way from the very beginning. And while I kind of, you know, accept some of what Jonathan said, I would refer that, you know, that universal credit, its black heart exists within the dynamic benefits policy paper from Ian Duncan Smith's Center for Social Justice, I think it's called. So, you know, the idea of Ian Duncan Smith coming out and speaking with forked tongue around the very policy which he designed from the end of his own pen to then criticise it for publicity points later on, you know, is really galling, to be quite honest. And specifically around universal credit, when the government talks about catastrophic impact. Well, I again refer you back to the very first pilot carried out in the north of England around universal credit, where 7 out of 10 people got into rent arrears, unmanageable rent arrears, and food poverty almost instantly. So this isn't a new information to the government. This is, again, as I said, purely by design. This information has been publicly available all the way through. The narrative has been completely at odds with what the actual facts and empirical truth has been. But that kind of context then, you know, if you're a disabled person, now where do you find yourself? Well, you find yourself in the UK where you're 3 times more likely not just to live in poverty, but in severe deprivation, according to the Equality and Human Rights Commission, where actually 1% of housing is accessible, where you don't have one of two countries in the world where you don't have a right to accessible, to inclusive education, and where your human rights were dismantled, including in things like social care, over COVID. And as we, you know, the difference between kind of disabled people and the people who administer our resources is that they want disabled people to be written out of the story, whereas we want, they have a vision of a future without disabled people having a stake, whereas we believe that we have a stake right at the centre, along with the workers and service users in our community and our friends and neighbours and work colleagues, that we should be the one to chart the vision and build a world which is in our image and meets our needs. And, you know, that's why kind of it's important that disabled people are challenging everything that's going on. And it's kind of why at the end of the month, what you have is you have a judicial review into the decision not to apply the £20 uplift that was given to those on universal credits, to those on legacy benefits like ESA. And those on those legacy benefits at the minute are living on a third of what the Joseph Rowntree Foundation says is a minimum income floor. And that's a really, a terrible state of affairs, as we go with pretty much a blank page into the future, where actually what we have shown is that all the things that we thought were undoable can be done, that we can actually be bold and be brave about what we aspire to. And disabled people have long kind of come up with our own creative visions, and we have our solution to social care in the form of the National Independent Living Support Service, which last year we got voted through into the Labour manifesto. But you would never think it, if you listen to any of the tripe that's been coming out since, but particularly this week. But we also have a first principles vision of what a welfare system looks like based around claimant groups and in support with the University of Warwick. So that's part of pushing back against this, is both in the courts, both with vision building, but also the most importantly on the streets. And Deepak is going back onto the streets again on the 28th of September, in support of those taking that judicial review. And we have an action we're calling Audio Riot, because there was a very significant line given at the department or the Working Pension Select Committee last month by a universal claimant. And I can't remember her name now, but she said, it's almost like it's been whispered that actually there is no noise and no pushback around this almost at all. Nobody knows what's happening, and this could be the most devastating of devastating cuts over the period of a decade, and almost we're all being led into it blindfolded. So we're creating an action in central London, 12 o'clock King's Cross on the 28th of September, where we're asking people to bring as much noise as they can, anything that makes noise, and take part with us to create a space where we can actually get this message out, that this is not just happening to disabled people, but as you say, millions of universal claimants right across the United Kingdom.
And I'll make sure I plug that again properly just when I finish. And just before I again bring in Nella, Andy, I mean, in terms of the material impacts that people can understand, what are the kind of choices every day disabled benefit claimants are having to make? And what will be on a kind of daily life kind of level, what kind of impact will that £20 reduction have.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
So some of the stories we've seen is because, of course, this cut isn't taking place in a vacuum, there's lots of services that have been dismantled over a period of time. So what we've seen is particularly one that strikes my memory is someone having to pay £100 out of their universal credit to get hospital transport to get their treatment for cancer, because both hospital transport has, of course, has been removed right at the sharpest edge. And what you have is someone there literally choosing life or death, that they're actually having to choose to go and get their cancer treatment or miss it and heat and eat. You know, and that's the kind of choices that we're hearing on a daily basis, really.
Nella, if there was a government minister here, what would you say to them?
I would say to reevaluate the whole system when it comes to this type of thing. I think I would start by saying, especially as Andy pointed out very well, is that we really need someone to look into how badly it affects the disabled people in this country. I've seen on many occasions, because I actually run a Facebook group, the Socialist Board, and we've just started a little group to kind of like, it's a little, just a little bulletin board. Anything is a proper issue, someone can just pop in and say, hey, look, we need donations here, whatever here, that type of thing. So I started that on that note because there was this woman that, similar situation, had to pay out of her universal credit to just get to hospital appointments, to get to job centre appointments as well, which the job centre, they don't pay you back for all these travel costs and things like that. For example, in my own case, I live in a small town. I have to travel a bus and so forth to get to the job centre. And it's, you know, that's about nearly 10 quid a pop every time. And it really does make a difference between, you know, £10 for the bus, which you don't get back from the job centre, to a week's, well, maybe not a week's worth of shopping, but like maybe a few days worth of food from Aldi. So it really does make a difference. And if they do get rid of this £20 a week, then that's going to leave a lot of people, once again, going to the food banks, going to places where it's, you know, their last option, or even having to do the extremes, which is crime or whatever we can put down to, just to have a few extra pounds in the pocket.
And Nella, for those watching or listening to this on the podcast who aren't going to be affected by the £20 cut, but are angry about it, what would you say to them?
I'm really, you know, I'm really grateful that people are still sympathetic. If they're not in the same situation, that just shows, you know, even if you're not in the same situation, you have empathy, and I thank you for that, because there's a lot of times where people are put on benefits and they're judged for it, and that, you know, apparently we're called scroungers and lazy and we don't want to work. We do want to work. We do want to work. But when there's things like this, it can discourage your motivation. It can discourage your mental health. It can discourage your well-being. Because if you're not living on enough as it is, you can't look after yourself properly. Yeah. You can't feed yourself the right foods. Sometimes you'll go a few days without food because bills have come out. Something has cut, a debt has come out, and that puts your general well-being down. So I can see the whole stereotype of we're lazy and things like that. No, we're just depressed and anxious and mentally unwell because of a system that doesn't work for the greater good.
Andy, just kind of, I suppose, just coming to the end of this, because I don't want to take up too much of your time, I know how busy you are, but do you think that maybe being a positive, looking for a positive, is there has actually been quite a sea change in attitudes, partly, I have to say, because of campaigning by the likes of Disabled People Against the Cuts. Because at the beginning of the 2010s, polling was really terrible when it came to issues of the welfare state and benefit claimants. The kind of way people who were struggling were demonised as lazy and scroungers and all that kind of thing had really cut through with a large section of the population. There's no question. And anyone who knocked on doors in that period can remember that. But there has actually been a shift in public attitudes. And I wonder what you think that's down to and how it could be built on, because this universal credit cut is not popular. And actually those cuts were alarmingly popular in the early 2010s. So how do you think that's changed, and how can it be built on?
So I think there's a couple of things. I think firstly, it's down to the fact that there are now generations of disabled people who've demanded more from the world around them, who have looked to the revolutionary movements of the past, both in the UK and overseas, and taken inspiration from that and learned from that, and learned that the world has to be reshaped to reflect our lives as well as everybody else's. And they've come up and they want to be involved in sports and science and teaching and architects and builders and all the trades, and they want to be, you know, volunteers, and they want to, you know, take part in their local communities, and you know, rightfully so. And those people have demanded more from the world around them. And I think, you know, there have been huge sacrifices made by those movements, people who have gone out and put themselves at, you know, at huge risk, you know, to forge a path. And I think we owe, you know, today in 2021, a huge debt, and I would go so far as to say everything we have, to those movements who have gone before. And I think we only stand here because of their good work. I think how we go forward is by recognizing that actually now there is, and I think what is coming across is that society is ready, more ready to accept the fact that they have disabled peers and neighbors and family members and partners and teachers, and that actually we recognize that if the world is to function at all, then it has to be around everybody, and that people are more willing. I don't think we're, I use this phrase a lot, but I don't think we're talking to people's backs so much anymore. I think people have turned their heads now, and I think it's up to us to kind of, build a vision of the world where, you know, we take an equal part, and that is kind of designed for us to, you know, to thrive as individuals, as a community, and to help everybody else learn from what we have given and what we have contributed to society so far, and what we're willing to learn from people going forward.
Andy and Nella, really, really appreciate both of your time. It's been absolutely brilliant. You've really both shone a light on what this actually means to people's lives in practice, because often, as we know, the media portrayal cuts out the voices of those actually affected, and statistics don't cut through to people in the way that people's lived experiences do. So you both so brilliantly and articulately explained that. And Disabled People Against the Cuts, I just want to do another plug, because they've been absolutely incredible and inspiring and courageous over the last few years. If the test of a society is how disabled people are treated in terms of how civilized a society is, then my word, how this society fails abysmally. And just to plug again the protest that Andy mentioned, so that's on the 28th of September at 11:30 a.m. and it's at King's Cross Station, which is obviously central London, in the courtyard in front of the station. So if you look up, if you type DPAC, which is DPAC, and you Google audio riots, one word, you'll find the website with the Facebook event link, and you can click on that. And people, it says here, it's going to be lots of fun. That DPAC will be providing materials, but they're encouraging people to bring drums, whistles, cymbals, bells, klaxons, and loudspeakers. I think it's important to make this point because the policing bill, which has been driven through Parliament by this government, essentially attempts to criminalise peaceful protests and talks about, you know, basically banning protests which cause a noisy and a nuisance. That's the point of protests. They're supposed to be noisy and a nuisance.
Of course.
So that's why people fought at huge cost for the right to protest, because it's supposed to be inconvenient to force people to be heard. And DPAC have always forced people to listen to the voices of disabled people, whether they like it or not. So,
yeah, of course.
Hugely important. So both Nella and Andy, you've been really brilliant. Really appreciate your time. So
it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Owen, for having me.
It goes without saying.
Thank you.
And thank you so much, and I'll speak to you soon. Lots of love.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. They were both brilliant. We're very lucky to have such brilliant guests. Labour. Just going to meditate for a second. I just don't even know what to say anymore. Honestly, don't know what to say. So I am not going to say very much now. If you've not heard about this, you're just not. I still haven't processed it. Let's just bring in Jess Barnard, who is the chair of Young Labour, a brilliant activist, the sort of activist the Labour Party in a rational world should be celebrating and putting at the absolute forefront of its campaigning. Hey, Jess, how you doing?
Hello. Not too bad. All things considered, not too bad.
Quite weak. Let's have a look at the puss. Let's see the cat first. For those who are listening on the podcast, it's a very beautiful puss. What's the puss called?
This is Bellatrix, Bella.
How very She's, sweet. It's a black and white puss who looks extremely happy.
Look at the camera. Yeah, here we go.
Here we go. Very sweet. Sorry. Yeah. We can just talk about cats.
It has to be part of every call I do, so...
Well, I think we should. Maybe we should just talk about cats instead.
Do you know what? That would be much more pleasant, really, wouldn't it?
I'll just explain what happened. So, I got an NEC member got in touch with me on Friday because you had emailed NEC members about a notice of investigation, which is a disciplinary letter, essentially threatening disciplinary action against Labour members for violating the Labour Party rules. On the basis of two tweets. Let's have a look at these tweets, shall we? Let's bring up one of them. Competition time. Guess how many TERF accounts, that's trans exclusionary radical feminist accounts, I had to block today. Closest guest gets to pick a charity supporting trans people for me to donate some of my council allowance to. Voting closes in 24 hours. Let's have a look at the other tweet. Expect better from a Labour representative. These accounts stalk, harass, incite hatred and abuse towards trans people. Why on earth a Labour council would defend them is completely beyond me. There's no fishing for anything. I just won't be intimidated into giving transphobes energy. Now, I know some people might be watching this or listening to this and think, well, there must be more to it than that. There must be something else. Come on. It's not those tweets. What's possibly wrong with those tweets? That's just the chair of Young Labour calling out bigotry against one of the most marginalised minorities in the country. But that was the basis of the notice investigation. So, and just quickly explain, you got this at 1 a.m. in the morning. I looked through it myself, spelling mistakes. And also it said it was about posts on Facebook. They're not posts, Facebook, they're Twitter. Now, I mean, obviously it's no biggie. It's just Labour's disciplinary system, which has been the focus of political debate in this country for years, actually, as it turns out. Keir Starmer's allies have been, they've only been running the party for a year and a half, total control of the Labour Party. What did you think when you got that letter?
I still really don't know how to describe it, really. I think there's a part of me that isn't surprised. Okay, you know, I think I've been quite open about the difficult relationship that Young Labour and myself have had with the party, you know, and I think, you know, particularly kind of party staff and bureaucrats. So I think there was part of me that was expecting this. Obviously, I've seen quite a lot of left-wing activists targeted, you know, and also solidarity to those that are also getting similar kind of just outrageous complaints and investigation notices through. They're just completely ridiculous. that might not have the same platform that I do. But yeah, I'm just so upset that we're at this point where we're prepared to basically, you know, align the party with transphobes and transphobia and use it as like a factional weapon to attack people on the left or people that stand with trans people against these attacks. And that's a really sad thing to think about our party. You know, that's not why we joined the Labour Party. That's not why young people and LGBT have stood by the Labour Party and repeatedly voted for the Labour Party over the years. So it's just really, really like heartbreaking, really.
I'll come on to that wider issue of the relationship between Young Labour and the party hierarchy, because there have been various briefings to journalists about essentially what a showdown between the Labour leadership and the Young Labour wing of the Labour Party, which you obviously are democratically elected chair of, with a democratically elected committee. So, I mean, I'm trying to work out still. There's a few theories which have been running around. The writer Alex Nunes, who people may know his work, he used to work for Jeremy Corbyn himself from 2018 onwards. What, I mean, do you have any theories about what was happening? Because I have to say, just even strategically, it's so bizarre. It's just such a bizarre, unhinged thing to do, which, you know, obviously they were forced to U-turn because of the outrage. But what's your, do you have a working theory?
I have some ideas, I guess. You know, I think there's a lot that isn't kind of in the public eye. There's a lot that's been kind of going on behind the scenes. And I think it just feels like far too much of a coincidence that, you know, this, as for my understanding, this is based on a complaint that was perhaps made a very, very long time ago. And you know, according to Alex Nunes from sources in the party, was dismissed by the GLU.
Which everyone knows is the government's illegal unit, which runs the disciplinary. That's right, Derek. I know, yeah. It's just the Labour wogs.
I know. And yeah, it's just, that must have been dragged up by somebody after being dismissed by GLU. So that kind of makes me feel like, you know, this kind of isn't an accident. You know, I have written to David Evans expressing my...
He's the General Secretary.
General Secretary of the Labour Party. I'm expressing my concerns because I think it's actually just not good enough. And what kind of message do we want to send to young people who stand up for trans rights or are trans? Is this... You know, are we going to just say, well, if we don't factionally like you, we'll hound you out of the party? It's just really shocking. I'm not really sure. I don't really know what my theory is at this point, but I'm feeling quite like there is a coordinated effort to kind of push socialists like myself out of the party.
Which I'll come on to just after this other question, which is, I mean, look, a lot of people have raised the point that Labour Party has a transphobia problem. There are a lot of people within the party, from activists to higher up, who've used their platform to support and endorse anti-trans talking points, support anti-trans rhetoric. And trans people are one of the most marginalized communities in the country. Transphobic hate crime has quadrupled over the space of 5 years. The statistics on trans people is, in this country, the experience is alarming. About half are scared to use a public toilet. About one in four young trans people have been homeless, huge rates of suicidal ideation, huge numbers report being discriminated against at work, in education, being abused in the streets. The vast majority don't report those experiences to the authorities, so the official statistics only scratch the top of the iceberg. And I suppose you kind of think, with Labour, we have our disagreements, to say the least, on various issues. You kind of think, though, that there'd be a consensus on LGBTQ rights. I don't ask for much in life, just not being the enemies of LGBTQ people. That's all. That'd be great. Because actually, whatever criticisms I have of New Labour in government, they actually did do good stuff on LGBTQ rights. And a lot of people on the right of the party would champion that as well. So I suppose the point now is, look, you've got allegations, for example, about Rosie Duffield, who's a Labour MP for Canterbury, who likes just awful, awful tweets by anti-trans activists. And we've, you know, just reams of them, liking tweets saying that trans people are cosplaying as the opposite sex, that kind of thing, and sharing articles denouncing the transgender thought police. I mean, imagine that, the homosexual thought police. I mean, so what do you, I mean, Jet, what do you think about the fact, you know, LGBT Labour, which it should be said, its leadership is not on the left. They don't have our politics. They're loyal to the Labour leadership's politics, but they've demanded Rosie Duffield's whip is withdrawn. But there's various other senior Labour politicians who are guilty of a similar behaviour, but no action's been taken. But you, the most prominent young activist in the Labour Party, you had a notice of investigation for opposing transphobia. What does that tell us about the state of all of this?
Exactly. I think it tells us that the complaint system still is completely not fit for purpose, and that we currently have a leadership that is, you know, I think determined to run away from this issue and to not hold transphobes accountable. I think, you know, the framing of this as some kind of marginal issue that working class people don't care about. It's just the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. You know, trans people are working class people too. You know, and LGBT rights have always been really important to Labour's voters. So it's very, very, very tactically silly in my view. But also it's just creating a situation where particularly trans people, but also, you know, the wider LGBT community, particularly given like the arguments that are being used, the kind of things that are being supported by like Rosie Duffield and things are similar arguments to the things we used to see, you know, like in the 80s used against particularly gay men. You know, these are being recycled, and these are you know, phrases used by the far right to attack LGBT people. So it's no wonder that young trans people are turning away in their droves from the Labour Party. Like, it broke my heart when you know, the investigation against me was leaked, because my timeline was full of trans people leaving the Labour Party. And you know, the party, if they want to prove that they stand on the side of trans people, if they want to prove that they could be trusted in government to support LGBT people and not go back on the rights that, you know, that we've fought for and that trans people deserve, then, you know, come on, they need to prove it. Like, show us. Actions speak louder than words. Take action on transphobia. Introduce a definition. Work with groups that are fighting transphobia to create a system that actually works, and stop using factionalism in such, you know, in such a hurtful way, in such a derogatory way, in such a harmful way. You know, it's just astounding.
One of those young trans members who left is someone called Arthur Weber, who's one of my favourite people on Twitter. Young trans guy. Look him up on Twitter. He's at Bernie Tranders. It's very funny. Bernie is in Bernie Sanders, but Tranders, TR instead of Sanders. And he wrote this letter resigning as a young closeted trans man at university. I found a safe haven in my Labour Students Club, a group of people who not only respect my identity, but encouraged me to stand and make a change. When I eventually plucked up the courage to go to my first constituency Labour Party meeting, I was met with love and acceptance. My constituency Labour Party eventually encouraged me to stand to be a Labour councillor, and I ran whilst openly trans. I was fully prepared to receive backlash from the public for this, but did not receive any, and then said, did receive online abuse from members of the Labour Party. The party that loves to remind me it wrote and passed the Equality Act 2010, but allows members to advocate for this law to be broken to exclude and marginalise transgender people. The part of the NHS that says nothing as trans people die on waiting lists for treatment that seemingly never end. The Labour Party said it was for people like me until it wasn't. When a particularly prominent party figure engaged in casual transphobic behaviour for the first time, I wrote an article with the intent of helping the individual and the wider membership understand why such behaviour is hurtful to people like me. I have now come to the conclusion that the party knows full well this causes significant distress, but does not value us enough to protect us from harm. I've spent the last year debating with myself whether my very membership of the party is an endorsement of its poor treatment of its trans members. The pessimist in me has declared victory, and I cannot stand by and indirectly encourage this behaviour. I hope to return soon. Arthur Weber. Heartbreaking. And the Labour Party's welcomed in Trevor Phillips with his pattern of Islamophobia, whilst young trans and LGBTQ people are driven from their party. Disgusting. Just a couple of other things. So the broader context, I think, is important about Young Labour, because Young Labour have stuck to arguing Labour should have a radical domestic agenda. You could almost say the 10 pledges part, for example, which Keir Starmer won the Labour leadership committing to. So just want to flag that up, as well as taking an uncompromisingly progressive stance on issues of international justice, for example, the emancipation of the Palestinian people from an illegal and brutal occupation. How much do you think all of this is to do with this, basically?
Oh, this is hugely connected, in my view. You know, since we as a committee were elected, and we, you know, we've obviously just increased our kind of like majority, I guess, of socialists on the committee. So, you know, we're very much on the left, we're all like socialists, and we believe in, you know, significant change in society to improve young people's lives, and that's what we're representing and that's what we're campaigning for, and we were elected on that basis, in, you know, with an overwhelming mandate. But since we've been elected, the party HQ, I think it's fair to say, has worked to undermine us, has at every turn possible tried to halt or put up barriers or basically just stop altogether our ability to organise and support young members. For wider context, for people that might not be kind of familiar with Young Labour and how it works, we have no access to our own funds, we have no access to our own members' data, so we can't even send out emails without the party's approval. And obviously, if we want to organise events, the party can just arbitrarily say no, because they hold all of the strings for us to be able to do that. So obviously, when you have a democratically elected socialist committee that wants to do socialist events, that wants to do events where we talk about all the issues young people care about, you get party bureaucrats using those flaws in that system to prevent that from happening. And that's exactly what's been going on. You know, I tweeted a few weeks ago before this all kicked off about the situation we were in. After about 4 months of waiting for David Evans to communicate with young members that he had decided we would not be allowed to host our own conference this year, despite it being a party rulebook requirement, he promised to me that he would communicate that to young members. I waited 4 months. It still didn't happen. We'd received no communication from him. He'd also promised extra resources for us to deliver something at Labour Party conference nationally, and that had just not been forthcoming. We'd been ignored. I had been chasing party staff multiple times a week. It was causing us a huge amount of stress and putting a huge amount of pressure on us when the party was selling tickets to our members and we're expected to deliver something and the party were refusing to do anything to support us, to talk to us, or to approve our speakers, so they wouldn't even be allowed in to the conference venue. So that's where we are, basically. And so I think it's quite clear that there is, you know, a link between the hostility we've seen kind of come out towards me over the weekends, and the practice that we've seen from the party.
Just finally, what do you think is going to happen at conference? Do you think they will try and do some rah-rah-rah, take on Young Labour kind of thing? And the other thing, I suppose, connected to it, I mean, do you think they've basically decided, well, young people are going to vote for us, whatever happens, aren't they? They vote. Because obviously in 2017 and 2019, I mean, even the 2019 route, actually young support went up for the Labour Party then. Not enough to win, clearly, in 2017. And 2019 was a terrible defeat. And that's because, overwhelmingly, unfortunately, older people aren't voting for the Labour Party. Something which has got worse with every election since 1997, essentially. Do you think... You know, so what's going to happen at conference? And do you think a lot of this is just the sense of young people have nowhere else to go, so we can stick our fingers up at them, because what are they going to do about it? They're just going to come and vote for us anyway.
Oh, definitely. And I think a lot of it is a recognition that, you know, so many young people joined the... Sorry, my cat's laying on my keyboard. I'm a bit afraid to close this window.
Get involved.
I think there's like a desperate attempt to kind of undermine young members, because so many joined the party under Jeremy Corbyn. I think we had around 100,000 members then. We know that that's fallen quite significantly. We don't know exactly what our membership numbers are at the moment. The party haven't told us. But, you know, I think that this showdown that the party apparently won at conference, we don't really want. You know what I mean? We just want to get on with what we were elected to do. And nothing that we are asking to do is even that shocking or radical. It's just about creating a space where young people and young members are free to have debates, discussions, to get off Twitter and actually get in real life and start talking with each other and figuring out their political views, figuring out solutions to the problems that they're facing, getting together and learning how to organise in their workplaces against injustices in society, you know, standing together when they face oppression, particularly like the transphobia we see in society. And the things that we proposed for Young Labour Day at conference are exactly that. They capture exactly that. Empowering young members, housing for the many, black lives and racial capitalism, solidarity not charity, organising in your workplaces, the fight for trans liberation. These are all things we were asking to deliver at conference. We'll see if we are permitted to do that. I'm not sure yet, But of course, you know, I think what I will say to young members or young people listening on the call, you know, we are determined to deliver this. And this isn't just about me. If the party wants to come after me for this, fine. But there is a huge number of young people who believe in this, who are calling for this, and who are calling for you to listen to us and allow us to organise.
Jess, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much. It's disgraceful the way you were treated. But as I keep saying, I said in a video about this, as the song goes, they took on Jess Barnard and Jess Barnard won. So bad luck, Labour bureaucracy. Oh, you're going to come for the Queen. Better not miss. But lots of love. I look forward to seeing you at Labour conference.
Yes.
Sure we can talk and
we'll have to meet in person.
I know. It's so weird. We've never met. It's really bizarre. But yeah, I'll try and be sober for Labour conference.
Too stressful.
We'll get drunk. Don't worry about it. All right. Lots of love, Jess. I'll speak to you soon.
Thanks, everyone. Cheers,
and love to the cat as well. Brilliant stuff. Depressing, but bleak. All of what we've covered, to be honest with you. But that is, I'm afraid, the reality of the world we currently live in. We're taking the scenic route to a better world. Let's just put it generously, shall we? But it's been brilliant to have those guests. We've got, speaking actually of transphobia, we're very, very lucky this week to have an interview with Sean Fay, whose new incredible masterpiece, The Transgender Issue, is now out. Do buy it. If you don't understand issues to do with trans people, if you don't know any trans people, if you're confused about what's been talked about all the time on social media and all the rest of it, this is the book for you. It really does go into great, humane and powerful detail about what it's like to be trans in the modern world, what they're up against, and just, you know, the actual realities rather than the lies and myths that are propagated. So do please get a copy, but we'll have an interview with her. We will finally have our documentary about Who Owns Britain, as well as videos, as I said, at Labour conference and Tory conference. You make all this possible on patreon.com/ownjones84, because I'm hopelessly out of my depth, so I have to rely on brilliant team to do all of that, who you pay. So thank you. I'll see you next week on Sunday at 12 o'clock, as ever. And we will have, also to Harley the Salami, who says, how do we begin to restore power to party members? If the party won't respect its own rules, perhaps we need to protest and progress within. Got to organise and fight back. And the likes of Young Labour are doing that. That's why they're being victimised and harassed. They don't call it a struggle for nothing. It's not a walkover, it's a struggle. But history will damn those who are behaving in this way. I have absolutely no doubt about that whatsoever. So we'll, as I said, we'll have all these documentaries up. Do like the video, helps more people watch it. If you're watching on Facebook, come through to that. If you're listening on the podcast, thank you, and keep listening to the podcast, I suppose. We've got loads coming up. As I said, lots of love, everyone, and I'll see you soon. Bye. Thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you found that informative, educational, interesting, and isolated. Do support us on Patreon to keep the show on the road, /OwenJones84. Leave us some stars, that'd be nice. Spread the word. And I look forward to speaking to you soon.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.